Hi there, I'm K-Town, and on this edition of Mysterious Radio.
No, so the books came a while after the shows. So I've always enjoyed writing, and I've written a couple articles here and there, and done a few promo pieces and a bunch of pitches to different networks. So I've always liked that. And once I finished filming Beast Hunter, which was way back in 2010, 2011, around there, the head of the production company that I was working for gave me a laptop and said that he thought it would be a good idea if I wrote down some stuff about my adventures. And he thought it would make a good book one day. And then, unfortunately, I got really, really sick. I was diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer. And that took up all of my time and energy for about a year. But in order to get myself back and in order to start feeling like myself again, I started writing that book that I had planned. And that book turned into about 800 pages over the course of 10 years, off and on writing. And then that turned into 6 books.
And I'm sorry to hear about your diagnosis.
It seems like you're
recovering, though.
Yes, doing great now. Yeah, I mean, I'm more than 10 years out. I am back into what they call the normal population. So my it was touch and go there for a while. It was about a 50-50 chance that I was going to make it. But after 5 years, my oncologist told me he knows my dark sense of humor in regards to all of this stuff. And he said, well, I'm happy to say that you are officially back in the normal population and you are just as likely to die from cancer as anyone else, which is still pretty likely.
Wow, that's nuts. That is nuts. But it's... it's good that you made it through it. I mean, a lot of people don't catch it in time,
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It was, and if I hadn't been traveling as much as I was at the time, I wouldn't have caught it. I would have ignored the symptoms even longer than I had. Turns out that I had cancer for about 7 years before it was diagnosed.
Wow. And, I had no idea.
Colon cancer is very slow growing. So those colonoscopies are really, really important for anyone who's got any of the risk factors. So very important to get that and get it caught. By the time they figured it out with me, it was stage 3, which was not what I wanted to hear. But, I made it through.
Were you having colonoscopies before they caught it or no?
No, I wasn't. So I'm happy to talk all about it. My life is an open book, literally. One of the books that I just had, 200,000 Snakes, tells all about my cancer experience and journey. And anyone going through it, I hope that it helps them a little bit just to show that they're not alone and that, some of the awful things that you go through, just the terrible, embarrassing, and dehumanizing aspect of it is unfortunately shared by many, many people who go through this. So I was having... stomach pains, honestly, was my worst symptom for about a year. I was having these kind of stomach pains off and on, nothing too severe. And then for about 6 months, I was having these really weird episodes where I would get a sudden intense pain where it just felt like something was stabbing my stomach. Like it was this awful, awful, and it came in waves. So I'd get this pain that would last about a minute, then it would go away for a minute. Then it would last a minute, then it would go away, and that would happen for about half an hour. I'd be doubled over on the ground crying, and I knew that wasn't normal. So I figured that I had picked up something traveling. And at first, the doctor said, well, we know you were exposed to a bunch of parasites, so we're going to treat you for parasites. And then they said, well, you've got a pretty stressful, 2 jobs, so, we're thinking maybe it's stress. And then they said, well, maybe it's an allergy, maybe it's this, because I was 30 and I was pretty healthy. I didn't drink very often. I didn't smoke. I didn't have really any of the risk factors. And finally, they kind of couldn't rule out anything else. And the doctor said, we should just do a colonoscopy just to be on the safe side. And that's when they found it.
That's amazing. You know what? Your symptoms could have been anything else other than
exactly.
That's wow.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was the thing. was that, you know, I can't really blame the doctors at all for not catching it. I mean, it was such an extreme jump to think that that's what this could be. But yeah, it was wild. So I had to keep going back. And the whole thing was, and that I always like to tell people is to advocate for yourself. You know your body. You know when something is wrong, and, you know, push for that diagnosis and try to figure out what it is.
You're exactly right. You have to be your own advocate. I mean, because they'll send you home and you're not still complaining about, you know, what's happening, or you don't seem concerned about it. They won't check any further.
And that's exactly it. Yeah. And it was really because I had been traveling so much and I knew that I'd been exposed to some pretty nasty stuff that I really wanted to get to the bottom of it. Had it been, you know, a couple of years before that, I probably would have gone home and gone, I guess this will just go away.
Wow. I'm glad you caught it. And that is very educational. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
Okay. So we're going to talk about your book now. First, I want to talk about, tell us more about, okay, Beast Hunter. You know, I have to ask about that. Tell what network was that for, and tell me exactly what you were doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been doing wildlife shows since 2003. I've done stuff on Animal Planet, BBC, Travel Channel, and Beast Hunter was on the National Geographic Channel, which was my dream. Every show I've done has been an incredibly positive experience, but ever since I was a little kid, I've wanted to work with National Geographic, and Beast Hunter gave me that opportunity, and it was better than I ever could have imagined. So the show sent me all around the world to some of the most remote locations, living with different indigenous people, and learning their myths and legends and stories, and participating in their rituals and customs, and eating the foods, you know, all kinds of interesting and delicious food, and some not so delicious, and really hearing stories about mysterious creatures, what we'd call cryptids, and using my knowledge of biology, I'm a biologist, to say, you know, do other animals exhibit the characteristics that they're talking about? Because sometimes these animals sound really outrageous until you break it down and say, ah, well, you know what? Actually, you know, horned lizards shoot blood out of their eyes. So that's not so far out of the question. Electric eels electrocute things. So that's not so far out of the question. So I'd look at other animals, known animals in nature, and I'd also look at the habitat and say, could it support an animal like they're describing? And then the most important part, and this is where I think cryptozoology really comes into play, is I would say, why is this story important? Like, not really looking to prove whether the animal is real or not, but why is it important to this group of people, and why has this story persisted for as long as it has? And I loved every second of it, even the really difficult parts. It was just an amazing experience.
It sounds like it. That is incredibly interesting to me, because you seem, you know, to me, it seems like, you know, you may have found stories. I mean, you can confirm this for me or not. If they brought up seeing some type of mythical beast or creature or something like that, that hasn't been mentioned before, you know, you started doing this. I mean, there's a ton of them. I have a book with a ton. But did you come across any that no one had ever heard of before?
Yeah, we did. So it was really interesting because, so to get the show produced, you've got to write, you know, a script. And I put script in quotes beforehand because you never know what's going to happen once you're in the field. But you have to have a kind of show arc. This is, you know, these are the people that we're going to talk to. This is the type of stuff that we're hoping to find. But then it's always open to new possibilities. So unfortunately, we couldn't always deviate too much from that. But we did get some really interesting stories. So we were in Vancouver.
Yeah, but you came up with the script, right? Or did they do that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, yeah. You did. So I worked very closely with the production company to do all of this. So I came up with the list of cryptids, the areas that we'd go to, the styles that I worked with the producer and the associate producer, and this was definitely a joint effort. And there was no, when I say script, I don't mean they wrote down like what I was going to say. It's just a broad, like, these are the places we're going to go. These are the things that we're going to talk about. So when we were in the Vancouver area of British Columbia, we were investigating sea serpents, and the First Nations tribes that we were living with had these fascinating stories about Bigfoot. So we spent hours and hours talking to them about Bigfoot, and none of it's going to make it into the episode because the episode's about sea serpents. But while we were in West Africa, I was investigating the stories of Mokele Mbembe in Cameroon, the Central African Republic, and the Congo. And we heard stories about these other mythical features, you know, some that were triceratops like, and some that were you know, elephant like, but, you know, hairy, and just these really interesting stories that, you know, unfortunately weren't really with the narrative of the overall episode, so they don't make it into the episode, but I do talk about them in the books a little bit. And one that was that I loved, we were in one of the big outdoor markets in Cameroon, I believe, and started asking people, you know, hey, do you know about any mysterious creatures? What are some of the most interesting animals that you see? And this woman told me that she says, you know, the other day we were digging, you know, the men in the village were digging up a tree that had, you know, the roots were growing in the way of one of the roads. So they had to dig up this tree and get rid of all the roots. And while they were digging, we came across this creature that no one had ever seen before. And she said it was terrifying. It had, you know, it had no fur. It had really long claws and it was swiping at us and looked really aggressive. And its face was contorted and weird and all distorted. And as she's describing it, it sounds like this monster. And I'm thinking, I'm pretty sure she's talking about an aardvark. I think that she came across an aardvark, but she had never seen one before, and none of the other folks that were around her had ever seen one before. So I immediately had an answer for what this monster was, and was able to pull up on an iPad that we had. We were actually the first show to use an iPad. Like the day that they came out, we flew one, and to pull up a picture of an aardvark and say, "Is this the animal that you saw?" And she was so excited. Yeah, that's the monster. That's the monster. So I thought that was it was a cool way to see how some legends develop.
You know what's really interesting? I'm going to go back to Canada because you guys got a ton of really great, you know, firsthand accounts about Bigfoot, but you couldn't use any of that.
Right.
I mean,
right?
What do they do with that?
So, I mean,
you can't throw that away. Where did that where'd that video go, or what happened to that tape?
It's still with Icon Films. So we, we would film for between 14 and 20 days per episode. So you figure we have 14 to 20 days of footage to make a 42-minute episode.
Yeah, we need to hear that Bigfoot stuff. Damn.
It was really interesting. It was really fascinating. So the majority of their mythology around Bigfoot was that, and this was the Shnanamuk people. I'm probably butchering that. but they believed that Bigfoot was a member of the tribe that had done evil and had been sort of excommunicated from the tribe. And that like as they entered the wilderness, they became wild, and then they grouped together over the.
You mean from their own tribe?
From their own tribe, correct?
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And as it happened to more people, as more, you know, if someone committed a horrible, heinous crime that was, you know, caused you to be kicked out of the tribe, then that was how Bigfoot came about. And then they were, you know, wild men in the forest.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah, no, it was really cool. And like I said, you know, we have hours of it, and it's unusable for the episode, but I gained a lot from it. And
but they were saying they saw it with their eyes.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Wow. See, that's what I'm saying. We need to hear that stuff.
Had we got more seasons, we were planning on going back to do a follow-up on that. And the same thing in Indonesia. While we were looking for Homo floresiensis, or I'm sorry, we were looking for Orang Pendek, and came across some really great
stories.
That's
the giant ape, right?
It's the little Bigfoot.
Oh, little Bigfoot.
Yeah, little Bigfoot in Sumatra. So we came across these great stories that were more Homo floresiensis, which we know was a group of hominids that did live in Indonesia. So we came across some really great stories of floresiensis, and we did investigate those and got that to work into the episode a little bit. But then we had other people telling us that they have reports and had seen lizards that were almost twice as big as Komodo dragons. And I thought that's something, because we know that there were larger lizards in a larger lizard species and tiny elephants that lived in some of the islands of Indonesia at one point in history. So tried to get back there to do a follow up on that one, too. And unfortunately, that's when I got sick. So I wasn't able to go on that expedition, and none of the footage ever saw the light of day. But yeah, there's always more And more great stuff ends up on the cutting room floor than what you see in the episodes.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that's right. Okay, let me ask you something. Like, you mentioned Cameroon. Is that in Africa?
It is. That's West Africa.
Okay, that's why I was going through my head trying to think about where it was.
It's Cameroon, the Congo, and the Central African Republic all share a border.
That's what I thought. Okay. And like, say in well, you said you thought that they saw aardvark, which turns out they did. Mm-hmm. But what about, you know, some of these indigenous people that you talk to? Did they offer like evidence or anything like that that you could see?
That one was about Mokele Mbembe. So Mokele Mbembe is a supposed sauropod that has survived to present day. And we really
tell our listeners what that is. Tell me what it is.
Sure, yeah.
I don't
yeah.
know what it is.
A sauropod's like a brontosaurus. So a giant long neck dinosaur. And,
gotcha.
They call it Mokele Mbembe, or the one that stops the river, or he that stops the flow of a river, loosely.
You talking about like the Loch Ness monster like that? Or
nope.
Is that a plesiosaur? Is that what they keep saying?
Yeah, that's supposedly more plesiosaur, mm-hmm. but or some people say more. Yeah, there's a lot of, so I've been to Loch Ness also, and unfortunately didn't find anything there. I think that's a tough sell for me. But beautiful area. I love Loch Ness. I would encourage everybody to go just to get the scotch and some haggis.
Yeah, there you go. You didn't see nothing. No.
No. But Mokele Mbembe is more brontosaurus like, sauropod, the big heavy legs, long tail, long neck. And really what we found is an incredible story, but no evidence. And I was left believing that it's a cultural imperative. It's really one of these stories that needs to exist in this culture, even though I think that it is either mistaken identity or just an invented story in order to explain away some pretty awful things. So Mokele Mbembe, I mean, these are primarily the Aka people, they're called, and the Baka and Bayaka collectively are the Aka, and they're a pygmy group in West Africa. And they're the primary reporters of Mokele Mbembe. And it's a pretty tough life. It's a pretty rough area. There's a lot of dangers. There's a lot of difficulty. We didn't really see a lot of very young people or very old people. You see a lot of kind of, you know, people in their early 20s who are very strong. It's not easy to survive there. And there's a lot of dangers, but they pride bravery above almost all else. So if you say, I don't want to go down to the river at night because there are crocodiles there, then you might be looked at as weak. Or if you say, I don't want to go down the rapids right now because there are rocks that can smash my boat and none of the fishermen can swim, then you might be looked at as weak. But if you made those same statements and said, because of Mokele Mbembe, people would go, oh, that's smart. Yeah, you probably shouldn't do that. So it's almost a culturally accepted way out of doing these really dangerous activities.
That is funny. You know, because, you know, we would say, you know, I'm just not going, you know.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. I'm a chicken. Yes, I am. And I'm just not doing it, you know, but it's funny how they give a reason, you know,
yeah,
and then it's accepted.
And we, you know, there was a couple times when I was asking about crocodiles, and I mean, the crocodile is a dangerous animal. I've worked with crocodiles. I know how dangerous they are and I'm scared of them. And I will freely admit that. But the folks in this tribe, you mentioned crocodiles, and they would laugh. They'd laugh. Nah, I'm fine. As long as I have a knife on me, I'm not worried about a crocodile. It's like, whoa. They just had to have this kind of bravado and this kind of toughness. And that was just a huge part of the culture. But you mentioned Mokele Mbembe, and it's like, yeah, no, okay, we should avoid, you know, we should avoid those rapids. Or if a fisherman disappears, you know, a fisherman doesn't come back. That can happen because their boat hit a rock or because their boat just tipped over. None of the fishermen could swim that we spoke with. But if this is someone who's really well respected in the tribe, they would say, oh, Mokele Mbembe got them, because that's the only thing that possibly could have killed this person. You know, Jeff was the best fisherman that we knew. The only thing that possibly could have killed Jeff is Mokele Mbembe. And that was almost the way of coping with this loss and with all the dangers that surround them.
Let me ask you something. Do you think that, you know, when you go out and you're hearing these stories firsthand from these tribes, I mean, their motivation is different from Americans.
For sure.
I think, you know, they just want, some of these people just say things, they just want attention, you know, whatever. But when you go out and you talk to these tribes people, they don't want that at all. And sometimes they won't even talk to you about it.
Right. Yeah. It's not like they're watching, they're not watching the National Geographic channel.
Right. And, to see if they show up on that channel for a story or their hoax or whatever being believed by everyone. But do you find that their firsthand accounts, if it's not based on superstition, but do you find that their firsthand accounts seeing things, except for the one in Cameroon where she saw the aardvark. But do you find that they're credible?
And even,
do you find those more credible?
I do. Yeah. That was really the only one where I was left with the sense that this was a culturally necessary story, but firmly in the world of myth. And there, I go into a lot more detail in the books about why that is. And it's still an amazing story. And I still saw some incredible animals and got, you know, charged by a silverback gorilla and got up close with wild elephants and all kinds of cool stuff.
That silverback was in Africa?
It was. Yes, that was in the Central African Republic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But everywhere else and all of the other stories, people were very, very earnest. And what I found, a lot of people would say, I don't know what I saw. I can just give you a description of what it was. And I can, you know, I'll give you this description and I know it sounds crazy. And a lot of people, they'd say, you know, my friends make fun of me. They pick on me about this, but I know what I saw. And then there were others, like in Indonesia, when we would talk to people who'd seen Orang Pendek, and they didn't know why we were so interested in it. Because to them, this was just commonplace. This was, so in parts of Sumatra, there are Sumatran tigers, and we actually saw one night. I got up very close to a Sumatran tiger, which was incredible. But, they believe that tigers span both the physical and the spiritual world. So everyone we met with that we would ask about Orang Pendek, they'd give us the answer and then go, but let me tell you about tigers. That's what they wanted to talk about. I saw a tiger 2 years ago and it was the, and we go, cool, that's really amazing. Tell me more about Orang Pendek that you saw. And they'd go, oh, all right. Well, you know, it came in my house to steal sugar. You're like, what? Wait a minute.
Wow.
So, and to them, it's just, it's another animal. The most that we got out of people was, you know, my grandparents saw it more often than my parents. My parents saw it more often than we do. And nobody that I know has seen a young one. So, and I heard that over and over and over and over again. So you really got the impression that Orang Pendek is either extinct very, very recently or soon to be extinct because of that. Almost every sighting had that same characteristic. You know, oh, we saw an older one. We saw an older one. No, nobody that I know has seen a younger one other than my parents. My parents' generation saw younger ones, but
never seen two together or three together.
No, yeah, nothing like that. It's always known as a solitary creature and a wanderer and, you know, covers huge swaths of the forest, doesn't have a home territory. And most animals that meet those characteristics, they are very long lived and they need continuous forest. And unfortunately, so much of Sumatra has been broken up by either palm oil plantations or rubber plantations that they really, it's hard to find that continuous forest these days.
What about sounds or something that people reportedly hear or think that they come from these animals?
Yeah, people would describe the sounds of a lot of different creatures. And, you know, they could very accurately describe the calls of every creature in their forest. And that was one of the funny things. One particular gentleman that we were asking about Orang Pendek, you know, he's describing the sounds that it makes. He's describing when they see it, like, you know, day, night, that kind of thing. And he definitely got the distinct impression that I was a skeptic. And I'm an open-minded skeptic, but I will admit I was skeptical. And he just started laughing and he said, listen, the only people who don't believe in Orang Pendek are the people who've never been to my forest. And I went, ooh, good call. All right. You're right. I'm here for 2 weeks. You've lived here your whole life. Like, yeah, I believe you. And I think that it's a very Western form of arrogance to not believe in a creature until some scientist has given it a Latin name. But, you know, native populations know about these animals. There's never been an animal that was discovered in quotes by Western scientists that the native populations didn't know about. You know, the coelacanth had been eaten for generations. They had a particular name for it when it was, you know, rediscovered by the West. The okapi was known to the West before. I'm sorry, known to the native peoples before it was described. So,
I'm trying to think about the coelacanth. What is that? I forgot.
The coelacanth is the huge deep water fish. That's the ray.
Yeah. What is his name? What's the guy's name that found it?
I don't remember. He was a scientist who was on a vacation actually and saw it for sale in a fish market.
Yeah, you know what? I think he found it, and then I think his son went back and found it again for one of the channels. Might have been National Geographic or something like that. It was a wicked looking fish too. Oh yeah.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. And now they found multiple populations of them. So the first ones were found in Africa, I believe, and now they found them in Asia as well. And they just found another pocket of them within the last couple of years. But they thought they had been extinct for 60
million
years.
Yeah, for millions of years. Yeah, that was just crazy. Let me ask you something about, like, what about other phenomena? Did you ask them? I mean, I'm assuming that you would be inquisitive enough. If you didn't, forgive me. I would ask them about everything, like other kinds of phenomena, like, I don't know, ghosts, UFOs, aliens, I don't know, anything like that.
I wasn't seeking out that type of information. So I will say that the investigations were all very based in biology. I am a biologist, and I feel like, you know, my minor was cultural anthropology, which does have a spiritual component to it. I've read all of the major world religion books, so I'm very fascinated by that subject, but I'd hesitate to call myself an expert in it. So in fact, I wouldn't call myself an expert in you know, different religions, just very curious and interested in spiritual and, you know, other type of phenomena. But so while I did have a lot of conversations and people did share some really interesting stories, as soon as it strayed away from the physical world, you know, that was not something that was going to be in any of our episodes or anything like that. But my great uncle is Charles Fort, who was the first kind of paranormal researcher and, you know, the first
to document. You gotta be kidding me, man.
Yeah.
Great. Okay, say that again. You're great what?
My great uncle, actually.
Wow.
So my grandmother's great uncle. Yeah, it was Charles.
Yeah,
Ford.
I was looking for his books, and
I got them all here.
Hey, well, now let me tell you something. I heard his name mentioned in one of the most jaw dropping ebooks ever, or audiobooks ever. And this guy mentioned his name, and I thought, man, let me get on here and try to find some of his books, you know. And I knew they had to be really old. Well, I'm getting on like eBay and stuff, and these books are so expensive. You can't even find them hardly, you know.
So they do have a collected work of his. I'd say the Book of the Damned is the one that's my favorite, but Lowe is also really interesting. And they have all of his. I'm looking at my bookshelf right now to see if I can see it. So I have his original. I have the first edition signed by him and everything. But within the last 20 years, published a collected works of Charles Fort that a lot of times you can find on Amazon in paper.
Really? Okay. Collected works. Okay. Let me write that down. Isn't he the first person that had or one of the first people that actually gathered information about UFOs? Really, really, like a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So he gathered info on UFOs, and he was the first to document the now, you know, scientifically documented phenomena of ball lightning and raining frogs. He coined the term teleportation. He invented that term.
Such an interesting guy. I immediately started getting online trying to find his books and stuff. So
yeah, and the Fortean Society is still in existence and publishes a monthly magazine.
What's the name of it again?
Times is the name of the magazine.
Oh, yeah. The Fortean Times. Yeah. Yes. There we go. Let me write that down.
Yeah. It's all based on Charles Fort. And I know the editor of the Fortean Times. He's a great guy. He's a really good guy. Yeah.
Really?
He and I have spoken many times. And I think they're gonna write up a story on me, actually. But he's Are just, they? Yeah. I mean, it's just wild that this is. Yeah. So my great uncle kind of started a lot of this research and was the first to document all this stuff. So I'm always interested in the, you know, the more bizarre aspects of our world.
Well, that came out in print, right? 40 Times?
Yes, yeah, it comes out in print, and they have it electronically as well.
That's what I thought, yeah. You're talking about some killer issues. I mean, talking about some fascinating subjects, yeah. Yes, that's great. I'm very pleased to meet you.
Yeah, you as well.
That's so crazy. Your uncle is so cool.
Yeah, and it's wild too, because I was actually reading his books without realizing that I was related to him. And my grandmother, you know, when I was really little, I was always a wild kid. I was always catching everything I can get my hands on and, you know, raising venomous snakes in the basement and all that stuff. And my grandmother would say, oh, you're just like your Uncle Charlie. And I had no idea who Uncle Charlie was. So I just, you know, whatever. All right, Grandma, that's fine. Hattie. I always called her Hattie. So I was like, all right, Hattie, that's fine. And then I was probably in high school and she saw me reading one of Charles Fort's books. She goes, you know, that's your Uncle Charlie. I said, what are you talking about? She goes, Charles Fort, that's your Uncle Charlie. And I went, no way. And she went in their back room and came out with a whole stack of his books and some other paraphernalia, like a letter from him and some other stuff. And she said, yeah, this is all from your Uncle Charlie. Went, oh, my God. I had no idea.
That's incredible. Yeah. Amazing. Amazing guy. I'm still at the beginning stages of getting my collection, but I will have all his stuff. And I'd like to have all of the 40 and Times online, you know, downloaded all the online magazines and
things. Yeah. No, they're great. They're great. Really, really well researched and well written. And the illustrate, you know, the graphics are really, really fun and good.
Yes,
so I can see it on my bookshelf right now. It's called The Book of the Damned, The Collected Works of Charles Fort.
Got you. Okay. I'll have to get that one. I got it wrote down here.
Nice.
Okay, I want to ask you about, what about disappearances in connection with some of these creatures that people are reportedly seeing?
Yeah, so we, in Cameroon, we did hear about, or I'm sorry, in West Africa, we did hear about that a lot. A lot of times it was fishermen going missing. That was attributed to Mekele and Mbembe. But I would really say, you know, unfortunately, it's just attributed to the harsh environment that folks lived in. In Mongolia, we heard about disappearances in association with the Mongolian death worm, but often that's really there's a moral to this story, I think, with the Mongolian death worm. And the moral was always don't mess with nature, because everyone who died because of the Mongolian death worm, or everyone who disappeared because of the Mongolian death worm, there was always you know, they did it because they poked it, or they kicked it, or they jumped on it, or they threw something at it, or they did. So there was always a moral of like, don't mess with nature. So it's hard to say the truth behind that. Orang Pendek was not known to attack people. We didn't hear any stories about kind of a violent encounter or anything like that. The Mapinguari in Brazil, there are stories of disappearances, but I believe that the Mapinguari is a giant ground sloth, is a remnant population that still lives in the Brazilian rainforest, in the Brazilian Amazon, that's a giant ground sloth.
Yeah, but is that how they're describing it or no?
It is. It is. Yeah, so the really interesting thing about the Mapinguari, and this is in my book about Brazil, is that it's almost, you get two completely different stories based on if you talk to people who live close to the area where the sightings occur, or if you talk to people in the city. If you talk to people in the city, you get this legendary, massive, giant creature with one eye in the middle of its forehead and a horrible mouth in its chest, and it eats people, and it has backwards-facing feet that lead you into the forest and make you get lost and disappear. And if you kill a pregnant animal, the Mapinguari will eat you. And if you cut down too many trees, the Mapinguari will eat you. And these are all stories from the city. When you go into the areas where the Mapinguari is actually spotted and heard, you get a much more realistic sounding animal that really all of the traits meet perfectly with the giant ground sloth.
But I mean, they still exist, right? I mean, I know sloths do, but
I believe so. So tree sloths. Tree sloths we know of, a few species of tree. But giant ground sloths, most scientists would say that they went extinct about 10,000 years ago.
Were you always talking to tribes people, or did you ever go into the venture into the like cities?
Oh, yeah.
I'm thinking about the United States and England or something like that, over in London or something like that.
So I did another series called Legend Hunter, and that was more in the U.S. in England and Ireland.
Okay. In England, tell me something about England. We have a lot of listeners over there, so tell me.
Oh, yeah. So we did, let's see, in Ireland, we did the lost Irish crown jewels, and we did Jack the Ripper, which was fascinating in England. So less crypto, more just mystery. And in the U.S., we did the Beast of Bray Road, Lizzie Borden, conspiracy theories, which was a really excellent one. Did that kind of all over the country, San Francisco, Chicago, New York, Boston, DC, all over the place. And, a lost ship in the desert, a missing Spanish galleon. And
where is that at? Where was that?
That was in like the Palm Springs area.
Oh, tell us about that. I've never heard that ever.
Oh, it was really fascinating. So this was a Spanish galleon that was supposedly loaded with treasure and got lost and went, you know, towards where the Salton Sea is today. So, and then as the water receded from this big storm, the ship was stranded there and was supposedly buried in the sands, and then has been uncovered and reburied a few times throughout history where people will spot this. And it would have been a couple decades before the Spanish were known to have gone to that area. But there are some carvings from native tribes there that have predated the first, you know, known exposure to the Spanish. So it was a pretty interesting story. And we did find what I believe was a part of the ship. We found a nail that was dated back to that era, in the middle of the desert, that there's no way that this ship could have gotten there any other way than sailing there. And the only time that the river was present was when this Spanish galleon was supposedly found. So no treasure, but we did find evidence of the ship.
That's interesting there.
Yeah, wow. It was really cool.
What about, you said Jack the Ripper. So let me go back to that, because I had an interview, I think, a couple of years ago. A lot of people think that now they know who Jack the Ripper is.
There's so many different theories. So
yeah, I know.
I think that we found out too. But there's a lot of people
who think it is. Who do you think it was? Who do you think it was?
I think it was a man named Francis Tumblety. And a lot of Ripperologists, a lot of people who are really, really into Jack the Ripper, are very, very, very adamant that they know who it was, and they have their key suspect. And I don't think there's enough evidence to truly point to anyone at this time. But Michael Hawley is a researcher who I believe makes the best argument for Francis Tumblety being Jack the Ripper. And he was a suspect at the time. He did escape police custody. He did flee. He was arrested a number of times for a lot of different crimes, and he, what we found, the new evidence that we found, was there was a couple letters that were attributed to Jack the Ripper, and we were able to definitively match the handwriting on those letters with Francis Tumblety's writing.
So, okay, I haven't heard about him, but this guy thinks that it was, okay, Dr. Doyle. I don't know who he is or whatever, but yeah. See, everybody's got their own theory.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
It still is fascinating.
Yeah.
Okay. And tell me about something that you found. Like, tell me one of your favorite places. I mean, could have been anywhere. One of your favorite, even if it was from, would you say you called it Legend?
Legend Hunter.
Hunters, tell me, yeah. Even if it's about Legend Hunters or the Beast.
Oh man, so hunter. I would say one of the wildest and most interesting things was in Mongolia. We went to a place called Nemget, or the Valley of Dinosaurs, and so many dinosaur bones have been found there, and fossilized trees were just sticking up out of the ground. And as we were walking around, there was a just. Like literally stumbled over it. There was a nest of dinosaur eggs on the ground, fossilized dinosaur eggs. And that was surreal. Just so.
Who, if you find something like it, can you keep it?
No. As much as we wanted.
Why? How come you can't keep it?
I mean, it would be a national treasure. It's really, it belongs to the people of Mongolia and belongs in a museum in Mongolia.
Gotcha.
And
okay.
That's what we did. We did the right thing. We, you know, everyone wanted to take one. Everyone wanted to have that on their mantle, but it would have been very wrong. And we would have gotten arrested. For sure.
So it's, they were complete unbusted or cracked they eggs.
Were. Yeah. Wow, yeah. So we called. Crazy. Called the Natural History Museum, gave them the GPS coordinates, and they came out and picked them up.
Tell me about, like, your future plans. I mean, do you plan to pick that show back up or do something else in the future, or what do you have on your plate?
Yeah, so I've just I had the books come out this year. I've just finished a children's book that I'm working on, kind of putting the finishing touches on, and I'm going to be filming some wildlife stuff in the very near future. So I'm pretty excited for that. It's going to be for a friend of mine in YouTube, and I'll be able to. I don't know how many details I can give right now, but so I'm looking forward to doing that. That'll be in just in the next couple of weeks, probably released a little bit later this year.
That's awesome. Will you please keep me in the loop about that?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Thank you.
We didn't get to your book, but I want you to tell my listeners about your books because the whole series, as we were talking Absolutely. About, we came out at the same time. So tell them where they can get it and keep up with anything else that you're going to be working on.
Thank you very much. Yeah. So you can find me on Instagram at Pat Spain, patspain.com. And I've got 6 books that just came out. You can find them in Amazon or get any of your local bookstores to order them. Or you can contact me and I'll send you some. And they are it's called On the Hunt. So the name of the book series is On the Hunt, and there are 6 of them. About each, 5 of them are about different cryptids in different locations, and they're kind of darkly funny travelogues. So they really are just stories from the road. So they're, each one has, you know, about half the book is about the cryptid and the experience with the cryptid, and half the book is just funny, ridiculous stories, the crazy situations that you find yourself in when you're going to these really remote locations. And then the 6th book, 200,000 Snakes, is about my experience with colon cancer, surviving it, and then to prove to myself that I could still do this stuff, I convinced a couple friends to drive 3,400 miles up to Manitoba, Canada, and lay down in a pit of 200,000 snakes.
That's crazy. You couldn't pay me any amount of money to do that. None.
And I paid to do it. So
that's crazy. What kind of snakes?
They were all
different kinds.
Yeah, mostly they were garter snakes. There's the chance that there's a couple other species mixed in there, but for the most part, it's all red-sided garter snakes.
Okay, got you. Man, that's nightmarish, really. For people that don't like snakes, that's just a nightmare.
I love snakes, and even for me, it was overwhelming. It's a lot.
Very cool. All right, Patrick Spain, my special guest. All his books are available on Amazon, or you can contact him, and he will gladly send you some of those. And Patrick, please keep me in the loop about whatever you're doing on YouTube. I know you can't talk about it right now, but if you keep me in the loop and tell me, then I will announce it for you, okay?
Excellent. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
It's been a pleasure. Many blessings to you, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's been great. Thank you.
To find out more about our guest and all others, please visit our website at mysteriousradio.com. And I want to give special thanks to our co-creator and executive producer, Kim Kyle, who brought this show to you today. And working hard behind the scenes, our team of 4, I want to thank them as well. Follow us on social media and share the show with others that may like the subjects that we cover. I am your host, K-Town, and you're listening to Mysterious Radio.